listening to the Jackie Daily Show. Hey, it is good to be back with you. Feels like a week is so long. Lots has happened. I was on the Debbie Georgiatis America Can We Talk show. You can now see it at americacanwetalk.org, americacanwetalk.org, or you can find it on my Twitter at Jackie Daily Host, Jackie with no E, daily like every day, host, or on the Jackie Daily Show Facebook page or Debbie's website. And coming up, I have a new video with David Blackman on his podcast, which is the Energy Question podcast. Note the difference. Debbie has a show. David has a podcast. Shows are on networks. Podcasts are not. I have both. Don't make faces at me. That's what Debbie said anyway. So that's coming up. Energy Question podcast, which you can find on iTunes, releasing, I think, next week. And then I will be on stage at the NAPE, the N-A-P-E, North America Prospects Expo, the largest oil and gas conference in America. Not going to lie, it's kind of a big party. It's a great time. People in Dallas love to go to Houston for that. It's one of the big parties you look forward to every year. It's actually where deals happen. It's where all of the independent oil and gas companies come together to show off their prospects, their plays, their deals, and hopefully make deals and seal them right there on the floor. So that's what's going on. But I will be on stage with Rick Muncrief. Rick is the CEO of Devon Energy. Devon, you might know, is one of the largest U.S. independent oil and gas companies, kind of an industry standard bearer. And we're going to be talking about ESG, environmental, social, and governance investment criteria. Why do you care? Because right now there's a move to divest from the U.S. oil patch, divest from coal, firearms manufacturers, you know, cash stores, these payday loans and things like this. Basically, politically unpopular businesses, they can't get financing. Wall Street is shunning them because of what the government is saying about trying to put them out of business. They find it hard to get insurance. Essentially, they're being canceled. And that is the product of ESG gone awry. It is intended to be, you know, a way to show corporate responsibility with environmental policies, diversity on boards, good governance. Everyone agrees with good governance and being responsible and fair, everyone. The problem is it is not always what it seems. It's now an opportunity to reframe the debate around it. And I'll talk to Rick Muncrief about that on stage. Again, at the NAPE, my favorite conference. And then you'll hear me talk to two of my friends today who are in studio. I will have David Spady. He's the director of news and public affairs at Salem Media. And we're going to talk about the 580 million people around the world who speak Spanish, the 53 million in the U.S., the fact that, you know, though they are 17% of our population, and radio as a medium reaches 90% of them every week. The low count is like 82% every week. Chances are very high that they don't get to hear programming like you hear on the Jackie Daily Show or on The Blaze, on the Glenn Beck Show, on, you know, Chewing the Fat with Jeff Fisher, or Debbie Georgiatis' America Can We Talk, or David Blackman's The Energy Question. Chances are very high they don't hear this kind of content. Why? Because there's like no competition in this country. There is only a very hard, like socialist-leaning Spanish media. They do not hear messaging from the pro-freedom side of the equation. And there are people trying now to change that, which is very exciting. And in fact, I have agreed myself to permit my show to be translated into Spanish to be played on one of these breakout brand new media companies that intends to tell the other side of policy to the American Spanish speaking community. And what I've learned is that when you do a show, it's online, and most of them are now. what you have really is a worldwide audience. This is not just about American Hispanics. This is about anyone who has access to a phone, to a computer, who can get online and say, I know that the media in the United States is unique. I know that I can get content there that I can't get elsewhere. I have found this in the English-speaking world, and it's been amazing. People write to me from New Zealand, from the UK, from the Caribbean, from South Africa, even English speakers in places like Egypt, in Nigeria. They don't get content like you get on The Blaze. It is very pro-freedom. It is very traditional, conservative American values. But above all, it's not, I won't call it Republican. I won't call it libertarian. I'm going to call it pro-freedom because that's what it is. I'm far more pro-freedom than I am Republican, I promise you. So this is something that is really for the whole world. We can speak from here, Dallas, Texas, to anyone, anyone on the planet, Antarctica, as long as they have a signal and can get to the podcasting outlet at iHeartRadio, iTunes, Stitcher, Twitter, the website, JackieDaily.com. You can get the content. And that is what we're trying to do now with Spanish being the number two mother tongue on Earth. English is first, Spanish is second, covering about 7.6% of the global population. So if we can put the show in those two languages, you reach a significant part of the world, which is amazing. Very exciting. In the works, it is straight ahead. So my friend David Spady is an expert in media. He's going to talk about that and the opportunities we have there. And then my friend David Blackman is on the show. David Blackman is a senior contributor at Forbes.com. He also hosts the Energy Question podcast, as I mentioned a minute ago. Spent his career in energy here in Texas, and he wrote a piece that I think you'll enjoy, 8 Consequential Energy Predictions for 2023. Frankly, I mean, I don't give investment advice, but some of the best advice I've ever taken is reading between the lines of what David Blackman says. He does not give advice either. Okay, no one is telling you how to invest. I'm just saying, what he's saying is straight ahead, I think is very difficult to argue with. He'll go into detail about how the renewable energy sector will see a dramatic expansion in 2023, which then will result in the U.S. electricity grids becoming increasingly unstable. Also, how the oil and gas midstream sector will continue to be hampered by FERC and other federal agencies. The point is, who cares what Biden says about 9,000 leases, which is upstream, when you can't get anything that you produce from his leases to market because of the midstream attack, which is on pipelines. If the government attacks the pipelines, and some rabid, extreme green activist figured this out years ago, if you attack the pipelines, you don't have to attack the upstream oil and gas. It, in fact, will become stranded assets because how can you get it to market? You can't move it. So he predicts this continues. Goes on to talk about Europe's energy crisis becoming a calamity. It's going to go from horrific to worse next year. And he'll explain why. And why, because of the midstream pipeline attack, we can't help them as much as we otherwise could. We could be sending American LNG to Europe, storming the beaches of Europe, this time with LNG, but no, because of government policy. And this only benefits the Russians. This only makes Europe more dependent on Russia, which supposedly our government doesn't want to do. Right? Then he'll predict, following off the advice or beliefs of Daniel Yergin being one of the smartest guys on oil in the world, that oil prices will hit $100 again this year. Maybe as much as $120. That means average U.S. price for a gallon of gasoline will be $5 or above. Again, watch it happen. And now Biden will not have the Strategic Petroleum Reserve to tap very long. Apparently, we're down to about 45% of the reserve's capacity. It is never supposed to be used to bring down gas prices for political reasons. That is wrong. It is supposed to be used for emergencies and national security, but that is not what has come to pass. And maybe most consequential, he's going to talk about Saudi Arabia's membership application, which is to be approved to BRICS. BRICS is Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. Essentially, Saudi Arabia can decide it will no longer be trading oil in U.S. dollars. That would be the first time since World War I. That could destroy our currency more than anything, more than even the Treasury printing dollars down there in the basement, debasing the currency. This is a really big deal. And so David Blackman will be talking about that. We'll take a break. We'll be right back. This is the Jackie Daly Show, and I finally have my friend David Spady in studio with me here in Dallas, Texas. You probably already know who he is, but in case you've never met him and found him on the Wall Street Journal or the LA Times or CNN or Fox or ABC, he's president of the River Public Affairs Group, a strategic media and political consulting agency. I know him as a senior advisor, to the Salem Media Group. And maybe most importantly, these things I did not know. He is a member of the National Hunting and Shooting Sports Conservation Council, which is inside your U.S. Department of Interior, the Congressional Western Caucus Foundation, the Western Governors Association, and he's on the board of the Montana Outdoor Legacy Foundation. That makes it sound like you're a conservationist. Is that right?
Yes. Conservationist is a better term than environmentalist, which has been hijacked by the far left. But yeah, conservationists love the outdoors. And when I'm not working in media and politics, you'll find me somewhere in the mountains.
Let's pursue this just a little bit. Tell us the difference between conservationist and environmentalist.
Well, environmentalism has become more of a religion than even an ideology about protecting the environment. It's gone far beyond that. From a conservation standpoint, for example, with hunting, which as you mentioned, you know, I'm involved with a couple of different hunting groups. You can't have wildlife and good hunting opportunities without conservation of species. Hunting actually pays for conservation of species. So there's a certain tax that, you know, is applied to conservation efforts that wouldn't happen without hunting. So they both rely on each other. And that's what people don't understand many times, is that people who hunt, who enjoy skiing, things like that, are very interested in conservation, because that's what allows them to do the hobbies that they do, or the things they do in the outdoors. So most people that are outdoors people want to conserve the outdoors, but they also want to use the outdoors. And rather than protecting the public from the outdoors, as a lot of environmentalists do, we want to protect the outdoors for the public use. And that's in fact what Yellowstone Park was set up for.
Right.
It's for the public use. But yeah, with environmentalists, the extreme ones that think that, you know, mankind should not even be able to touch some of these places, that's not for the public use. That's, you know, really the environmentalist agenda trumps the public's agenda.
Well, and let's point out, this is not an insignificant amount of money that is raised from hunting licenses and fishing licenses. People don't appreciate, but I learned at Hunter Nation, where you and I were there at the same time for a presentation, that I think there are about 700,000 hunters in Wisconsin alone. Yeah. One state of 50, and most states have some kind of hunting, something you can do, worth showing up for. But 700,000 people just for hunting, that is larger than many countries' standing armies.
Yeah.
And so they're all paying their fees into the system. This turns into a ton of money nationally for conservation. Okay, so when I had you on the show last time, you had released a film, a short documentary.
Wolves in Government Clothing.
Yeah. Wolves in Government Clothing. I loved it. And so for those of you who didn't hear that years ago, they can still find the film, right, online?
Yeah, if you go to wolvesingovernmentclothing.com, you can watch it there. It really started out as a sort of little hobby home movie. Ended up in 150 newspapers. It was on Fox, CNN, National Geographic Channel did a segment on it. And it was all about, again, how the environmental movement was basically ignoring the rights of landowners and human interests in the interests of wolves, and doing so in a way that protected them, and they actually had greater rights. If a person comes onto your property illegally and trespasses or breaks into your house, you can do things to stop them. With something like a wolf, an endangered species like that, even throwing a firecracker on the ground that disturbs it in a habitat that they're deeming, you know, that endangered species should be in, it's a federal, you know, offense, and you can actually go to prison for scaring a wolf off from your property,
right?
Let alone actually killing one. So, you know, the radical extremists of the left often do things that are counterproductive, even for those species. Where I'm dealing with something even today with wildfire retardant that is used to, you know, put out wildfires in real hard to reach places. And we know how catastrophic some of these wildfires can be. And there was just a lawsuit that happened in the state of Montana, but it's a federal lawsuit that would apply nationally to prevent any use of fire retardant until the U.S. Forest Service goes through a 4-year process with the EPA to deem that this fire retardant isn't going to, you know, damage waterways. And, you know, they've already gone through that process themselves scientifically within the Department of Agriculture, but this lawsuit wants the EPA to do that. Well, if you don't use fire retardant, you can imagine the impact that's going to have on the river systems they say they're trying to protect, when you have all these burnt watersheds putting ashes and everything else down into these rivers. So it's a counterproductive environmentalism that actually does the opposite of what they're trying to achieve, or they say they're trying to achieve with some of the crazy things they do.
As a recurrent theme on my show is how oftentimes these environmental efforts backfire. And it happens far more often than people realize. But before we move off your film, because I want people to understand how powerful this was, and I'm going to do this from recall, so you correct me if I'm remembering anything incorrectly. There were about 60 wolves reintroduced into an area where they had long been gone. They multiplied like rabbits, like crazy, span out over a geographical area into populated areas such that parents could not leave their kids alone at the bus stop anymore in parts of the West. They had to build cages and put their children in cages because it was too dangerous, because wolves are a real threat to humankind in the West because of this experiment that proliferated kind of out of control. Am I remembering that correctly?
That is correct. So, you know, wolves are an apex predator, and they had, there was actually a time when the federal government was paying for wolves to be killed by anybody that could shoot one. There was a bounty on the wolves, and so it was an effort to exterminate them in the lower 48. There's certain apex predators that don't do well with humans. Grizzly bears are an example of that, which right now there's a lot of controversy in the West again over the grizzly bears, because they far exceeded, you know, an endangered level, but federal judges keep blocking, you know, the ability to manage them, which is part of what hunting usually is. California used to have at one time as many as 10,000 grizzly bears. There are no grizzly bears in California. So you can't say, well, because there were grizzly bears in the San Gabriel Mountains outside of Los Angeles, it's appropriate to reintroduce them and reintroduce a species that you actually can't do anything to even protect yourself from by law, because it's an endangered species. So you can imagine the problems you'd have if grizzly bears are wandering into backyards in Pasadena and, you know, wherever. And so the wolves are, it's a similar problem. They're actually more of a successful predator than a grizzly bear. Grizzly bears will eat berries and other things. Wolves eat meat. They're a predator that relies on that. So and they're also a more efficient killer than a grizzly bear. Certainly a grizzly bear is bigger and can take an animal down, but because wolves hunt in packs, they're very, very efficient killers. So they've devastated wildlife populations. So, you know, hunting in Montana has radically changed because of that. And of course, it's not just elk and deer and moose. It is, it's livestock. So suddenly, right, you know, you have all this predation of people's livelihoods, and there's nothing they can do about it. And there are programs to reimburse them, but many times something just disappears. You never know what happened to it. When wolves are around cattle, they move around a lot and it takes the weight off their body. So you're losing money when you go to market because they don't have the same weight. So there's a lot of reasons why they need to be adequately managed. And the way we manage them now, again, in Montana is through hunting programs, and also in Wyoming, the only reason, or Idaho, the only reason you can have hunting in those two states for wolves, which have far exceeded, you know, any kind of recovery numbers that were projected on what it would take to have them as a recovered species, is because two Democrat senators from Montana introduced a rider to a budget bill to delist wolves just in those two states. So they, you know, we have asked the Department of Interior through U.S. Fish and Wildlife to manage wildlife populations. They do so very scientifically and pretty efficiently, although they don't, there's not a lot of species that ever come off the list once they go on there. But, you know, you'd have a federal judge, even when, you know, the Fish and Wildlife has said with wolves back then and now with bears that they're recovered, and we'd need to let the states manage these predators like they do their other wildlife populations. And you'll have a federal judge come along and say, nope, you know, I see it differently, and stop it. So we really shouldn't have the Senate and, you know, Congress having to delist a species that we've given that, you know, we've empowered a whole department for that. But because of the way our courts are with the Endangered Species Act, we, you know, Congress has granted the courts an enormous amount of power to do that. So that film was about exposing that, and the extremes of it were actually in New Mexico, where they were reintroducing the Mexican gray wolf. And I was on a call, some ranchers in California were worried about wolves coming down from Oregon and what that would mean for Northern California. And they had this sheriff from Catron County, New Mexico on, who was talking about these, he called them, you know, wolf shelters. And I looked it up on my computer and said, how long have these been out there? And he said, you know, like 4 years. And I said, there's no news stories about this. I said, if I come out, will you take me around and show me these? And he did. And it was very eye-opening. And yet, you know, families living in fear because there was wolves on their porches and killing their livestock and their pets, and sitting in the fields next to the school bus stop when the kids were being dropped off. And of course, the parents weren't there. The bus driver couldn't leave. So again, it's the extreme thing where the rights of animals are put over the rights of human beings.
Right. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show, and I'm continuing a conversation with David Spady. David is the Director of National News and Public Affairs at Salem Media. Okay, so I'm going to switch gears from conservation over to one of our shared favorite topics, which is Spanish media. Whatever your issue, whatever you care about, environment, energy, other, there's a whole population out there that's not being reached. And that is the Spanish-speaking population of the U.S., which is about 17%. That's about 53 million people, a ton of people. But also, as I like to point out, because I learned this after I started podcasting and doing a show, we are the beacon of light to the world here at the U.S., you know, podcasting community, yeah, writ large. We don't realize that even in countries that we consider free, they don't have competitive media. They don't have liberal, conservative, libertarian, independent, yeah, neutral. They just don't. Even places like Canada and the UK, I would argue, are nowhere near as balanced as we are in this country. And so that is especially acute, I learned from you and others, in the American Spanish-speaking population. Where is the free talk, the freedom talk for them? And that's a huge opportunity. It's a huge problem. But now there's a lot going on to try to solve that problem. And it could be a game changer, I think, for the country. So explain to me sort of the landscape of where we are in getting what I would call alternative media, which is really maybe conservative, libertarian, moderate, neutral, Christian talk into our Hispanic communities?
Well, you know, as you mentioned, the United States is the has the world's largest immigrant population. Those immigrants who were not born here, most of them are communicating back to the world, you know, from here. And what they're learning about the way the world should work, can work, about entrepreneurship, about liberties and freedoms and all that is something that we can actually reach the world, you know, through basically communicating to the people that are immigrants here in a way that impacts the world. But impacting this country, when you think about the Hispanic numbers that you mentioned and Spanish-speaking people that whose first language is Spanish, big consumers of particularly radio, because
yes,
a lot of the jobs that they work in allow for that. And if you go to a construction site, you're going to find radios. You're going to find those in, you know, with farm workers and a lot of the type of labor jobs that they're involved in have, you know, radio as the media that they're tuning into. So, you know, being involved in the radio business with Salem Media Group that has, you know, 100 radio stations across the country, but those are the owned and operated. The bigger footprint really is the 3,000 affiliate stations that take some form of content from, you know, SRN News. It's carried on, you know, over 1,000 stations, and, you know, the talk shows that are broadcast far outside the owned and operated stations of Salem. That's a big, you know, big footprint. In the Spanish language side, there's really nothing on the center right. The left is dominant there, and it's not just liberal. It's the far left sort of socialist liberal that you get from most of the media outlets that provide news and information to that community. So when they migrate here from Mexico or, you know, Latin America or wherever, that is their where they're going to get their news. Partly because a lot of the Spanish news programs will talk about what's happening in Mexico or Latin America, and the English stations aren't going to do that. So they're big consumers of that. So the question from a both a political and getting integrated into our culture and having an impact in you know, making our country better, really requires that they have both sides and that they understand what liberty is, what this country was founded on. And, you know, there's the Cuban and Venezuelan immigrants have left a system that was very centralized control of lives and all that. And so when they come over here and see the freedoms, it's very different than when a country like Mexico, they're very, you know, socialist, but when they migrate here, they come with a different mindset. So you know, when you look at the overall Spanish or Hispanic population, it has a lot of diversity from the Cuban to the Mexican. But you know, I think part of the problem that the right has had, or the, you know, conservative have had, is how we have viewed Hispanics coming in here, not with welcome arms, but we've sort of, you know, said, who are you? You don't belong here. And when you do that, they're not going to listen to you, right? Because you're not being friendly. I've always thought that the wall should have been built on the other side of the border. I mean, reason for that, if you think about for Mexico's benefit, they're best and brightest, they're entrepreneurs, they're risk takers, they're highly educated, all left. They all came over here.
That's right.
And the people that stayed, it's, you know, it's like a community that everybody that really wanted to do something with their lives left. And the people that stayed behind are not going to fight with the cartels. They're not going to stop the bad things that are going on, because they would have left if they were motivated for, you know, in the same way. So I think a lot of Mexico's problems right now, even with the cartels controlling so much of it, goes back to the fact that a lot of their best and brightest and good people came here. And that's to our benefit.
Yeah.
I mean, these are hardworking people. They're entrepreneurs. They're like the people that left Europe to come to the United States, and the people on the East Coast that migrated west. And these are people who are willing to work hard to get things done, to change things, to be innovative, and that works to our benefit. So we do have a lot of that population that's come here for to have a better life. A lot of it illegally, you know, some of it legally. have benefited this country in many ways. But there is a lot of others that are coming in that are here for other reasons. They're here because they can make more money off government assistance here than they can in Mexico or you know, Haiti or somewhere else. So we obviously have a major immigration problem, but we do have a reality immigration problem. And the reality is that even since Biden's come into office, 6 million illegal border crossings mean that there's an increased population in this country that would be the 21st largest state,
right,
if just that population were a right state. And that has an impact across our culture. It has an impact in all of our neighborhoods. I mean, there's probably nowhere you can go in the United States where if you went back 5 years, you haven't seen a difference in the immigrant population of even small towns in Montana.
And we have to find a way to communicate with them. I can tell you, I walk outside my door every day to let the puppy take her break or whatever. I'm out in the front yard. There's always a house under construction on my street. And I promise you, I can hear Spanish music emanating from any construction site on the street, as you said earlier. I feel like actually, this is in stark contrast to where I came from in Appalachia, where there's not a lot going on.
Yeah.
There's not always a lot of go get it. You know, there's so much hustle to this population. They're here to take advantage of an opportunity. Those are our people.
Yeah.
Those are people who want the freedom. They want the message. I don't believe they have the option in most cities in America to go to the dial, you know, for their 8-hour or 10-hour workday and listen to anything other than what you were calling it. Maybe it's socialist, but if you're coming from south of the border, wow, you might have a full-blown Marxist dictatorship that you came from. It's what you're conditioned for. It's what you expect. And if it's never been put into your mind that there could be entire frameworks of thinking that result in a different system that's better for you and why you're here, you know, someone has to make the case. It doesn't just occur by looking around. So I think people are finally realizing this niche is here. And why has no one jumped up and taken advantage of it?
Well, the left has. And the left, I think, is always better understood than the right. The power of media to impact worldview. And people make decisions on how they vote and how they live their lives based on their worldview. And the left, through, you know, Hollywood and some of the stuff that in sort of on the fringes manipulates, you know, worldview, news and you know, direct opinion commentary is a more direct way of doing that. But the left, you know, understands that and has dominated both of those. You think back to, you know, not that long ago, we had 4 or 5 different television newscasts and they were all on the, you know, center left. Nothing really on the right until Fox came along in a national way. And, you know, they've dominated that space, understanding that if they want the world to be the world that they envision, their utopian or whatever it is, vision for the world, that they're going to have to impact people's worldviews. That's why I got involved in media, but from the other side.
But why is the right-hand side slower? Why did it take all that dominance of liberals before someone like a Murdoch says, wait a minute, what about 50% of the rest of America? And why is it now taking so long for the conservative side or libertarian side to jump up into the radio space? I can't understand why there's a lag time.
Well, part of it goes back to, I think, the underlying DNA of people that are drawn into journalism.
Well, yes. Okay.
There's a certain amount of elitism that goes into certain professions.
Yes.
And certainly from a journalistic standpoint, when you know that you're the gatekeeper of information and you learn how you can manipulate that, most journalists have a certain ego and there's a certain elitism there that even draws them as in their personalities to go to college and become a journalist. You can see that a little bit with the teaching profession. You know, why are the number one profession of delegates to the Democrat convention, members of the teachers union?
I did not
teachers,
know that.
And education dominated, especially at the higher levels, by leftist professors. there's a something about teaching these young minds and formulating their minds.
A captive audience.
That is has an elitist component to it.
Yes.
So I think part of it is just conservatives are not don't have that same bent that, look, we're smarter than you. And we're going to help you sheep understand how to live your lives. And we're going to do that through manipulating the news you get. So there's, I think that's part of it, a big part of it. When it comes to the Spanish media side of it, I think there's been two problems that we've had. One is, again, that sort of rejection of a new culture, or other people that are coming in here, even though we're a country of immigrants. I mean, with that's what most of us are. There's very few that are native Americans, right, that are we're, you know, go back generations and generations. So we should be more interested in how we bring people in and help them understand that what our founders understood, because those are sort of timeless, not just for us, but when we say our, you know, we're endowed by a creator with certain inalienable rights, that's saying that that's a human thing, not just only Americans within this geography are endowed with that. That's the world. And so how do we bring people from the world in to say, hey, here's this philosophy that we live by that has made America this exceptional place.
You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show, and I'm continuing a conversation with David Spady. David is the Director of National News and Public Affairs at Salem Media.
I think because, look, the people crossing the border, by and large, they haven't been brainwashed at woke universities.
Yeah.
Right? That's one big difference between them and the U.S. population under 40 or 45. So immediately you have an advantage because these folks live with like physical realities. They work with their hands, work gets done, they get paid. You know, so I think it's a huge actually advantage that no one's really paid attention to in the past, but now people are.
I think the converts we'll have in that community that will change from, you know, their voter registration and change sort of their ideological affiliation with, you know, the left here or liberals will be very quick because they are lined up with us on just about everything. I mean, family values are extremely important to actually most immigrant communities, but particularly the Hispanic community and, you know, the Mexican Hispanic community. They're either, you know, Catholic or evangelical, very strong people of faith. And when it comes to a work ethic, you know, I live in California, and when you pull off the off-ramp and you see a "will work for food" sign, I see a lot of white people. I see black people. I rarely see Hispanics. When I pull into Home Depot, I have six guys run over to my car saying, "I speak English," who want to work. They're not looking for a handout.
Right.
They want to work.
I've seen this myself.
Yeah. So it's ingrained into their, you know, into their culture and into who they are as people. So when you look at the agendas of the left and the right, you know, one that's all about handouts and control of people, the other is that it is about work and individual responsibility and a lot of things that, you know, are they clearly line up with. I think you'll see once they're educated on these things, they're lined up with Republicans. They're lined up with conservatism far more than they are the left and Democrats. But it's a matter of educating them and letting them hear the other side. And this is not, you know, this is something the left understands as well. And they're seeing those Hispanic numbers shifting. And they're going to do everything they can with media to make sure that you know, they're influencing there, which is why George Soros and some others have basically founded a media company that's focused on going out and buying up media resources to have that impact on that community. And when George Soros is involved, we're not talking about something that's going to be center left or mainstream left. You know, this is the far progressive elements that want to control that narrative with that community.
Right.
And something has to be done to counter that. And that's why, you know, we've had an interest in doing something with that community for a long time, but we're in the world of we're in the world of business, and it has to be something you can do in a way that you can scale it to make it profitable. And once it's profitable, it basically continues to pay for itself and expand within that community and in a much better way than just saying we're going to go in a nonprofit way and try to make something work. That usually doesn't last very long because people get tired of just shoveling out money for something. So we've had an idea for a long time to do that. And now we're moving forward and launching a Spanish conservative talk network, Hispanos.
That'll be amazing because, as I recall it, I was watching the deal that Soros kind of jumped into, or maybe through proxies, I'm not sure. But it was, you know, Spanish music, sports, but the talk outlet, which is in Miami, was profitable. And it was leaning conservative, or maybe very conservative. I don't listen to it myself. And even if I did, my Spanish is so rudimentary in first grade, I probably wouldn't follow everything. But the point is, like, I cannot wait to see that experiment and see how it's received, because I feel really good about things. The Soros group will have an uphill climb, because I have found some of the most strident pro-freedom people I know are the people who have fled South America, especially Venezuela. A friend from Chile who's old enough to remember, and parents telling her about how scary that country became. Oh. One from Argentina, one from Peru. These are some of the most strident people who say, you know, when those statues started going down, they're like, you better put a stop to that now. Oh. Like, let me tell you what comes next after the statues come down. And I learned a ton from them. And that community is ready for comms. They're ready to hear from people who speak their language. So as I mentioned at the beginning, I'm excited because I looked this up. There are 580 million Spanish speakers worldwide. That is 7.5% of the world's population. Obviously, most of them on this continent or the one directly south, for which there's a land bridge, and they are headed this way. So it's the second mother tongue of the world. As I said earlier, when I started the show, and I think I was on first KLIF Dallas locally, but we also then, I came to the Blaze, and it was just up on the internet. And we had this television screen inside the studio, and it was a globe.
Yeah.
And it would light up around the world when people were listening to us on the website. So you could see, like, every morning, the U.S. East Coast would light up at 6 a.m., millions of people, and then across the country every day until you get to California till the day's over. And there are always people, like, you know, four people in Somalia, you know, three people in this tiny Caribbean island in the middle of nowhere. I would get mail, like, on social media or on the website from people in South Africa, in Canada, in Australia. And it really opened my eyes to a lot of these countries don't have, as I said, competitive media.
Yeah.
They turn to American conservative media because you can't hear that anywhere else. So if we have a presence here in the States for our population that speaks Spanish and we put it online, I promise you, we are serving people all over the world.
Yeah.
Because even, you know, look at English and Spanish alone. If you cover those two languages worldwide, there are a lot of people who speak at least one of them.
Yeah.
And so that's super exciting. It's a mega, mega market. And right now, not a lot of people are jumping up to grab it on the conservative side, but I know of an effort that I'm excited about. So let's see what we can talk about a year from now, 5 years from now, because it may be a very different landscape. It may be the Rupert Murdoch play on radio.
Yeah.
So that's exciting.
Well, you're exactly right. We can have an international impact, and certainly we need to do what we can to protect, you know, what this country is and from forces that want to take it a different direction. And a lot of those forces use these immigrant populations for their agenda. And they're able to do that in many cases because they're not hearing another side of the story.
Right.
And that's what we need to tell.
Competition is so often the answer to so many problems, competition and transparency. And so I predict if we have a conservative offering, even just online on the conservative side, we'll watch some changes. So I'm talking to David Spady. He is the president of River Public Affairs Group, a strategic media and political consulting agency. You've seen him on, can you believe this, CNN? They let him on CNN. Fox News, ABC, even NBC, and writing for the top newspapers in the country. He's a filmmaker. As I said, you can still watch the film. I enjoyed it so much, about the reintroduction of wolves into populated areas, or maybe not populated areas, but they've spread out after multiplying like crazy. You can see the kids in cages we were talking about on his website. Is it wolvesandgovernmentclothing.com?
Yeah, that's the website for the film, yeah.
Wolvesandgovernmentclothing.com by David Spady. David, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. This is the Jackie Daly Show. This is Jackie Daly Show, and I have David Blackman in studio with me, which is fantastic because he's been on the show many times in the past, a repeat offender. He is with Forbes.com as a senior contributor right here based in Texas, more in the Fort Worth direction than we are. But a person who has made his career, as a matter of fact, just watching U.S. energy, what's been going on, the trends over decades. I trust his judgment. Read him religiously. So happy to have him here. David, welcome.
Hey, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So I want to start with your 8 consequential energy predictions for 2023, which I found persuasive and compelling. These are the basics that everyone should know. If you want to understand where we are in terms of fossil fuels, energy transition, geopolitics, where we stand on the world stage vis-a-vis others, this is a great primer. So let's start with number one. You say renewable energy sector will see dramatic expansion in the United States during 2023. You thought this was the easiest prediction. I also thought it was the most logical to put first as I read through the order of your predictions.
Yeah.
So, okay, explain that. How can you know that for sure?
Well, the Inflation Reduction Act, $369 billion of new incentives and subsidies. You know, that's the low-hanging fruit in that piece, right? You know, it's easy to predict. I have, gosh, over the last 6 months, and in fact, just again yesterday, I've interviewed the CEOs now from 8 different startup companies who are coming into the United States to build batteries, to do solar installations and other things, other technologies related to green energy. And it's all motivated by the incentives and subsidies in that bill. And there was another $150 billion or so in the bipartisan infrastructure law that was passed in 2021. So you've got $500 billion.
Plus the state incentives on top of the federal incentives.
Right, exactly.
Or maybe even local incentives, depending on where you are.
Yeah.
And so basically, what I hear you say is the government took a lot of our money out of our pocket in the forms of taxes, made a big trough, and said, line up and you can have it if you have a renewable company. And this is one time of many. I remember in like 2007 or 8, I was in Washington, and I felt like one day I just woke up and all of my friends were in solar energy. Like all of them, like yesterday you were a lawyer, yesterday you were a physicist, yesterday you were a staffer on Capitol Hill. Today, you've joined a brand new solar company.
Right.
And so, which was exactly the same thing as what you just described, but
happened long ago. What's coming. And it's not, it's all going to get multiplied in the economy several times over because private equity is going to chase those projects that qualify for those subsidies. And, it's going to be a big driver of the economy and growth, hopefully growth anyway, in the U.S. economy for a decade.
So prediction number two, which I think followed number one, not by accident, is this. U.S. electricity grids will become increasingly unstable as a result of the renewable incentives. And I ask everyone, just look around. Growing up most of your life, did you worry about whether or not there would be any electricity when you hit the light switch?
No,
because you're an American. You don't have those problems until now. So explain why.
Yeah, we had Central Power and Light down in Beeville where I grew up in South Texas and never had a blackout. And we had winter storms about once a decade down there, very similar to Winter Storm Uri. And you never had to worry about the lights coming on or being able to heat your home because it was all generated by coal or mainly, but natural gas as well back then. You know, and now you're trying to replace all that with, you know, 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week energy with intermittent sources of energy that don't have any battery backup to speak of yet, despite all the promises of the climate lobby. And, you know, on a day like today, it's cloudy outside. Solar is not going to generate as much as it's rated for or even close. The wind's not blowing out there today. It's not blowing in West Texas today, I checked. And, you know, so you're not going to get much out of wind and solar on this particular day. And when the sun goes down, the wind tends to die at the same time sun goes down. You won't get anything for 12 hours or so. Well, you can't do that. The laws of physics don't work this way. And so it's just a natural outcome of doing what we're doing to our grid. And we're doing it here in Texas, just like they've done it in California, unfortunately. You're going to become increasingly unstable, and that's what we're seeing. And, you know, you just have to pray you don't have another event as bad as Uri this winter.
Right. So number three, the oil and gas midstream sector will continue to be hampered by FERC. Okay, number one, for people who are not familiar, define midstream and FERC.
Okay, yeah, midstream is pipelines, basically, and processing plants for natural gas that remove the liquids and put the dry gas into the pipelines. And it's, you know, it's the part of the value chain that takes the production from the wells. That's the upstream. Midstream is the pipelines and processing. And then the downstream is refining. And so the strategy of this administration to hamper the oil and gas industry in our country has been to attack the midstream sector by denying permits for any pipeline that crosses a state line has to have a permit from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the FERC, and they've been holding them up. And so we have capacity constraints coming out, even over the Permian Basin here in Texas now, shortage of pipeline capacity. And it's really much worse out of the Marcellus Shale up in Pennsylvania. And you know, as long as this president is in office, it's going to get worse and worse. And that
restricts
growth.
But he talks about 9,000 leases, David.
Yeah.
What good are 9,000 leases in the upstream if you can't move the stuff with a
exactly.
pipeline, right?
Yeah. I mean, what good's drilling wells if you can't put it in a pipeline? And that's the whole strategy. So the anti-oil and gas lobby figured this out about 15 years ago, and this presidency is the outcome of it.
Well, and the saddest part of all is you point out this will hamper the growth of U.S. LNG exports at a time when the world desperately needs it. Here we can be the number one natural gas producer on Earth. If we have the way to get it to market and the incentives that are proper, Europe, obviously, Germany, desperately needing energy, otherwise relying on Russia. And here we are constraining America's ability to meet that need.
Yeah.
So isn't this helping Russia?
Oh, completely. Yes, absolutely. It helps Russia. It helps Saudi Arabia. It helps Qatar, which is a big exporter of LNG. Helps Algeria, another big exporter, Australia. But who it doesn't help is Europe.
Yeah, that's right.
Which needs natural gas. And Asian countries like Sri Lanka and Pakistan. Pakistan had an 18-hour blackout nationwide yesterday, the day before we're recording this. And it's because they don't have enough natural gas. They can't get it. Europe's eating up all the LNG exports. And we're not producing enough additional capacity right now in the United States to make up the difference for them. And unfortunately, so this is having domino effect all over the world with developing nations who really desperately need the LNG. And unfortunately, our administration is restricting that.
And really, this is a life or death issue. People don't realize if you don't have the energy you need, just like we had in Texas in 2021 with the freeze, people die. Hundreds of Texans died in that storm, and no one talks about it.
Right.
No one wants to take responsibility for that.
Right.
But in fact, I'm sure in Pakistan too, I mean, there are mountains. It is cold in some parts of Pakistan.
It is,
not to mention they have hospitals to run. So rather serious. Okay, the next is Europe's energy crisis will evolve into an energy calamity in 2023. We're hearing this everywhere.
Yeah.
Explain that.
Yeah, so, you know, the big news out of Europe for the last few weeks is that, well, we've had a warm winter, and so we're not using as much natural gas as we were afraid we would. And so we still have a lot in storage. But it's getting cold there this week, and it's forecast to stay cold, very cold, frigid cold, across Europe now for several weeks and really maybe the next couple of months. And so this is going to turn into very rapidly that storage isn't going to last very long. You know, it sounds like a lot of gas, but at winter rates of consumption, it really isn't much. And so they could go that through that in a hurry. And I think by the end of this winter, we're going to have a pretty severe shortage that's going to result in pretty major price hikes, costs of natural gas and to the consumers of electricity. And I think we have to hope that it doesn't result in the same thing that happened during Uri here, where you have blackouts where people die. And I don't never want to say, you know, predict people are going to die, but, you know, that's a possibility. And then the other thing that's going to happen towards the end of the year is Europe's not going to have enough gas to refill their capacity for the following winter. And that's going to be where the real crisis is going to come.
Yeah.
And again, our restrictions on LNG export is going to play a role in that, unfortunately.
So we should be storming the beaches of Europe this time with natural gas to the rescue. And we could. We are capable
if we
actually had the regulatory regime that would permit it.
You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show. And I'm continuing a conversation with David Blackman. Mr. Blackman is a senior contributor at Forbes.com and also a Texas-based public policy analyst and consultant. He is the host of the Energy Question podcast, on which I will appear next week.
Your next prediction, oil prices hit $100 again in 2023. You cite to Daniel Yergin, who is one of my favorite people to read. I've read all of his books twice, The Prize, The Quest, The New Map. He's a pretty smart guy.
He's a very smart guy, yes.
Yeah.
He's the vice chairman of S&P Global,
So, all right, that means what you really cued into that I think is important that nobody talks about. The price goes high, maybe as high as $121, when China fully reopens from COVID-19. Okay, I try to point this out. China is like many countries in one in terms of its people and its market. And so when they shut down maybe like Shanghai or a region, that is bound to have an impact on the price of the commodities, meaning the Chinese government can impact revenues of, you know, it could be Russia, it could be U.S. Oil producers or whatever, the entire market just by making a decision about one region.
Yeah.
And so that's people don't realize maybe there's more to their decisions than COVID-19.
It could be.
Maybe there could be more going on.
There definitely could be, yes.
Because they're some of the most strategic people. So, okay, high oil prices means for us high gasoline prices.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's no way around it. So how high do you think gas prices could go?
Well, I mean, so last year in May, early June, it went to $127 just for a few days. Gasoline prices spiked to $5 nationwide average, right? For regular gas. My car uses premium. So I was paying $5.60, $5.70. If it goes to $121, as S&P Global predicted in that study, then it could go to $5 again easily. And particularly if that happens, which I think is going to happen, right when summer driving season starts and demand really goes up in the United States. Well, that U.S. demand, just like China, is a big driver of global oil prices. And so when you go into summer driving season, supplies of oil always get tight. The price always goes up. It corresponds to when refiners have to start making these dozens and dozens of different summer blends of gasoline, which is also very costly and causes the price to rise. And so I just think around May and June again this year, we could see $5 gasoline prices here in the United States.
And President Biden is not going to have our strategic petroleum reserve to tap this time.
He's not.
So will he pull out of the hat this time?
Although his energy secretary was just on TV 2 days ago, you know, implying that that's the plan again, even though they've depleted it to 45% of its capacity or 40% now of its total capacity, the lowest level since, 79, I think. They're thinking about doing it again and taking it down, I guess, to near zero.
Right. I was going to say that just effectively eliminates the Strategic Petroleum Reserve without law created by the people's representatives that say we want that.
Right, exactly.
It doesn't matter what we want. It'll be gone. And because of bad policies, I'm still amazed even now. People ask me all the time, is it true that President Biden is really hurting U.S. energy? He keeps saying he's doing everything he can to be helpful. And I have to like count to 10, count to 10. I was counting the policies for a while. The Western Energy Alliance made a list of 80.
They're great. Yeah.
They're so good.
They did
they're
great work.
I've had them on the show. These are both policies and proposed policies to kill oil and gas production every way you can possibly imagine. Then I started adding on top of it and then lost count. I can't even keep up with 1,001 ways that they take aim at U.S. oil and gas and our energy security.
And one last thing about the SPR that people need to understand. It's there for energy security and for national emergencies. As we record this, President Biden today announced we're going to send 31 tanks to the Ukraine. We are sleepwalking into a shooting war with Russia at a time when he's still wants to deplete our Strategic Petroleum Reserve even further. You've read the prize. You know how crucial the supply chain for fuel to our tanks during at the Battle of the Bulge and the campaign in Europe, the campaign in the Pacific, won that war because we cut off their supply lines, kept ours open. That's why we won the war.
That's right. That's right.
And we're sleepwalking into this same situation again. And the president wants to eliminate our reserve. It's crazy.
Imagine if we had had a green agenda in the 1940s.
Oh,
across every federal agency like we have right now.
We'd all be speaking German.
Yeah, there's no way.
Yeah.
Whoever, we can't emphasize enough. It's actually my favorite topic is geopolitics more than anything else.
Me too. I love it.
It's the chessboard.
I don't know enough about it, but I love it. Yeah.
It's the chessboard. And so, the two world wars are really a story of energy. It's a story of oil and gas.
Yeah.
And electricity and how do you power your ships? Churchill had to ask himself and make decisions. These were critical, pivotal decisions in the history of the world. I'm off course, but that's because it's my favorite.
No, I'm sorry.
My favorite topic.
Hysteria.
No, it's very important because let us never talk about the Strategic Petroleum Reserve without saying the idea that you use it to bring down gas prices is sacrilege. That is an awful misuse. And so
not why it's there at all. Yeah.
America is now conditioned for it, but that is wrong. It is not for that purpose. Now you have good news for American oil and gas producers. You say America's shale industry will happily stay in its new sweet spot.
Yeah.
Excellent. So what do you mean by that?
Well, we got into a sweet spot really over the last year and a half in the shale business. And it's, I know a lot of companies have complained about the pressure they've had from their investors to increase returns on investment, slow down on the drilling. For a decade during the shale boom, the big boom, everybody took on a lot of debt to drill wells, get the national production up, and did that to record levels, all-time record levels, and incredibly successful. But a lot of companies ended up going bankrupt, right? And so investors have became concerned along about 2018, 2019, started pressuring all these big producers in the Permian Basin and the other shale plays to let's cut back on drilling and have some better rates of return on our investments. And that pressure has forced companies to become more efficient, more effective at what they do, streamline their operations, streamline their employee bases, their headcounts, and they become wildly profitable. The best performing sector in the U.S. stock market last year, by far, no one else was even close, was the oil and gas industry.
Yeah, so, and we were told 10 years ago, David, they would be out of business and stranded assets, right?
Yeah, stranded assets. I love that. Yeah, we can talk about a year about that.
Right.
So this year they're going to do the same thing, and they're going to do the same thing until they're pressured to do something else. And what that means is we're not going to have a huge increase in national production. It'll probably rise by 500,000 barrels a day again, just like it did last year. But the sector is going to remain very profitable with these strong commodity prices. And I think now all those companies that were itching to drill 5 years ago are really happy.
Oh, yes.
To just keep the same thing going. Right?
Yes.
Have a little stability for once.
You know, one of the best things about doing my show is that I know this ahead of time. I mean, I can see the writing on the wall. So I went long, very long, on LNG, royalties, oil, and coal. I knew what was coming.
Yeah.
I went through my portfolio yesterday, and I'm telling you, if it weren't for my fossil fuel investments, I would have had my tail handed to me with the index funds, you know, things that are normally considered safe. So I don't give investment advice. I'm not telling you how to invest. I'm just explaining a true biographical fact, which is that, wow, boy, am I happy. I didn't believe 1,000 news stories telling me that fossil fuels were dead when the fundamentals and the math, as you said earlier, is just not there for that to change right now.
You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show, and I'm continuing a conversation with David Blackman. Mr. Blackman is a senior contributor at Forbes.com and also a Texas-based public policy analyst and consultant. He is the host of the Energy Question podcast, on which I will appear next week.
Here is, I think, the most concerning part, the last two predictions of your paper. Number one, Saudi Arabia's membership application to be approved by the BRICS, that is the BRICS Alliance, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. And then this signals that Saudi Arabia will put an end to the era of the petrodollar.
Yeah.
And what we're talking about is oil is traded in dollars, U.S. dollars. If that changes, that's a scary, scary, unprecedented change in my lifetime. So explain why we care about that. Why is that a big deal?
Well, the United States dollar since the end of World War I has been the mark currency for all petroleum trades on the international markets globally. And that has played a very big role in making the dollar the most powerful currency on earth, right? And not just for oil transactions, but really for international trade in general. And Saudi Arabia has made a lot of noise about farming alliances with China. They're the biggest supplier to China now for crude oil. They have had numerous discussions with Xi Jinping, just came to Saudi Arabia recently, and they've had a lot of discussions about joining BRICS. If Saudi Arabia were to join the BRICS alliance, that would mean that alliance would probably be a more powerful geopolitical force than the G7 or the G20. Because you would have the two biggest economies in Asia, the biggest Middle Eastern economy, the biggest economy in South America and Brazil, the biggest in Africa and South Africa, and two of the three biggest oil-producing and oil-exporting countries on Earth in Russia and Saudi Arabia, and the second biggest consumer of oil in China. You know, the United States is the biggest producer, But anyway, it would be incredibly powerful. And then if you, and Saudi Arabia, I wrote that story 6 weeks ago. Saudi Arabia just last week again said, we are certainly open to, doing all trades in a currency other than the United States dollar. So this is not anything that they're forgetting about. This is going on. And BRICS has its annual meeting. This year it's in South Africa in September each year. And I believe that when they have that annual meeting, they're going to announce Saudi Arabia as their new member. And when that happens, it's going to have incredible geopolitical consequences for the rest of the world, particularly for the United States and Europe. And if the U.S. dollar is no longer the currency of mark for international trade, you're most likely going to see a pretty significant devaluation of the dollar because of that. And so the potential consequences for our country and every person who lives here are really enormous. And I think it's also important to note that this is happening because the Biden administration has intentionally pushed Saudi Arabia away. And it's just, it's crazy. It's just
a
nutty thing.
I was just about to say, Saudi Arabia would not have dreamed of making this decision 30 years ago.
Oh, no.
Wouldn't have dreamed of it.
Yeah.
It's a strange relationship, right? It's hard to know who's running the gravy train sometimes. So we could be their biggest customer, perhaps, because we consume so much. And they're sometimes the biggest consumer. They can cut us off, such as in the 70s, yeah. and show us who's yeah. boss during the Arab oil embargo. But we had this agreement that we provided defense for them. And it goes back, the relationship to, I think, the 30s, if I recall,
yes.
in Jurgen's
yeah.
books, which is fascinating how the world
yeah.
powers rushed to the Middle East to try to form these relationships. Mm-hmm. And ours was with Saudi Arabia and others. But now that's falling apart. And I think part of it is, as you said, the Biden administration has gone out of their way to do whatever they can to harm the relationship.
Right.
At the same time, we have ceded so much ground to China by mm-hmm. forfeiture. And so the Middle East, I was told by an expert who does security there, they have this strong horse mentality, which is there's so much turmoil there. They're always looking for who's the strong horse.
Right.
Because you don't want to be on the losing side of a Middle Eastern conflict.
Exactly.
So they're looking around and saying, who's the strong horse, the G7 or the BRICS?
Right.
I mean, it's probably...
And which one of those is growing, right, in terms of economic strength and geopolitical leverage?
Yeah.
Well, it's certainly not Europe and the United States.
Right,
So, yeah, from there, you look at it from Saudi Arabia's self-interest, it makes perfect sense.
Right. All right, I'm talking with David Blackman, and I can't believe it's been almost a half hour already.
Yes, it goes it goes crazy fast.
I have a stack of David Blackman articles. You should not miss them. I cover a lot of them on the show and podcast. I wanted to get to Texas is flush with money, largely thanks to oil and gas. This year, Texas has $32 billion. I'll get to this in my show this week. That is an enormous, monstrous surplus.
Crazy, yeah.
When other states are struggling, and it's because of oil and gas severance taxes is the bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot to be learned there. And thank God we have that money. We need it. We're basically manning the border by ourselves. So we have our hands full
yeah.
here. But please, if you don't follow David Blackman, you really should on Twitter, LinkedIn, or his website. So tell us, what is your Twitter handle?
It's Energy Absurdity, believe it or not.
Yeah. Energy Absurdity. LinkedIn, that's David Blackman with an O at the end. And what is the URL for the website?
Blackman.substack.com. I'm on Substack and everything's there. And I try to also cut and paste my Forbes stuff, a couple of days after it goes live. And, everything I'm doing, I try to put there.
Excellent. Well, I learned a ton from reading you and following you. It's fun to finally have you in studio. Rather than over the airwaves or over the phone line.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Enjoyed it.
All right. Like I said, follow David, Twitter, LinkedIn, and on his website, he has a Substack column. You can support him there.
You can.
And you should. All right. That's all I've got for today. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show.